This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be viewed on Free Speech TV and on our website. Donald Trump over the weekend dropped yet another bombshell less than 2 months into his presidency, and he did so in his signature series of angry tweets complete with typos. Trump started out with this inexplicable tweet. Terrible. Just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism. Trump then followed that Twitter explosion with another four tweets accusing the former president of tapping his phones. The claims appear to have no basis in fact and may stem from a Breitbart story. The assertions came just as calls for Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions to resign were reaching fever pitch. And on Monday, Trump also released a new version of his executive order on restricting the travel of Muslims to the United States. Joining me to try to sort all of this out is Marcy Wheeler. She's an independent journalist specializing in civil liberties, privacy, and the war on terror. She blogs at mtwheel.net, and she's a frequent contributor to this program. Welcome back, Marcy.
Thanks for having me.
So first, let's talk about what specifically you think Trump means when he says that Obama was spying on him. As far as we know right now, the only thing that he's basing this on is a Breitbart article?
Right. The Breitbart article, which came out, it was based on a Mark Levin radio rant Thursday night, written up Friday. And it was based on the first report that there was a FISA order taken out in the counterintelligence investigation of Russia's ties to Trump associates. But it confused another story, which was debunked already by the time that this article was written in October, about a server that was pinging, it was a Trump server, pinging both Alpha Bank in Russia and Spectrum Health here in Grand Rapids. And it turns out another 14, 15 servers that the package story didn't tell us about. But that server was a marketing server. Even assuming the worst about that story, that server was located in Philadelphia. But the writer of that original FISA story mistook that and said, they're targeting a server in Trump Tower. Just confused a bunch of things. There were subsequent reports that there was a FISA order taken out against two Russian banks, two, not one, not just Alpha Bank. But everything got collapsed in that story. So that original article said that the target was a server in Trump Tower. Absolutely not true. I mean, it would have been a server in Philadelphia, and also said that because it covered any Americans that were using the server, it covered Donald Trump. It is true that sometimes the FBI gets orders tied to, you know, a facility that people use, and had Trump used that facility, say a bank account, then he would have been covered. But it implied that Trump was definitely being targeted by this. So that gets dumped into the Breitbart story. It's like a bad game of telephone, right? So that Breitbart picks that up. Andy McCarthy, who's a conservative former prosecutor, picked it up and said it was improper because it wasn't an intelligence function, which it definitely was. And then Levin and then Breitbart, they explode it at every level. And then Trump takes it one step further, because the article itself never said that Obama ordered the wiretap. The way it works is FBI goes to the attorney general and to other people to get it approved, and the court approves it, but the president isn't in that loop. But, you know, Trump, maybe speaking metaphorically, took it another step further and then said, you know, Obama wiretapped me in Trump Tower. Horrible game of telephone. He's accusing the former president of personally wiretapping him. And that's all based off of a Breitbart article.
Wow. I mean, it just is unbelievable that we're living in this political moment today when a sitting president, rather than vetting something as fact, just spews this stuff out in a public forum, because now we're in an extremely serious situation. Either Obama really did personally tap Trump's phones and Trump's assertions are real, in which case a huge breach happened, or, which is more likely, the second is more likely, that Trump, a sitting president, made a completely baseless accusation against a former president. Either scenario is explosive.
Well, this is the same guy who still insists that Obama was born in Kenya. So it is akin. I mean, it is par for the course for Donald Trump. The other thing that's really interesting about this is remember that Jeff Sessions recused himself from the investigation into the Russian election hacking on Thursday. Monday, he said that he was going to recuse himself. He was thinking of recusing himself anyway. So he was already most of the way towards deciding that, at least as he explains it. And then subsequently, there were these disclosures about him having these conversations with the Russian ambassador. But it's important that this basically conspiracy theory started right after Sessions recused himself, because Trump did not respond well to that. He was furious about it. And you know, with Trump, you can never tell. Was he furious that Sessions recused himself because he feels like he isn't controlling the situation? Or was he furious that Sessions recused himself because he feels like he's lost control of an investigation that he knows could be compromising to him? We don't know the answer to that. But what we do know is that in response to that, he basically read this article and that was itself a conspiracy theory, based on bad reporting, and then escalated it and made it a bigger conspiracy theory in a way that discredits the investigation into him.
Right, exactly. So this is now, or it's his attempt to eclipse the controversy over Sessions. It also now all of a sudden is this kind of classic misdirection. You know, if someone accuses you of something, you turn around and accuse them of something worse or something similar. And then, of course, we've got this added dimension of James Comey, the same James Comey that some people say threw the election by making speculations on Hillary Clinton right before the election. James Comey turned around and suddenly said, I mean, I'll just read the two back-to-back New York Times headlines. Comey asks Justice Department to reject Trump's wiretapping claim, which is also just amazing that a FBI director would openly contradict his own sitting president. And then the next headline, Trump is set to reject Comey's assertion that wiretapping claim is false. I mean, we have this he said, she said happening at the highest levels of government. I mean, this should be absolutely embarrassing the United States on an international level.
As if everything else wasn't already embarrassing. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing about Comey, and I've covered Comey, you know, I raised objections when he was nominated by Barack Obama and pushed through by Democrats to be FBI director, because even at that point, it was clear that he had kind of oversold his role in standing up to George Bush and downplayed his approval for torture and for wiretapping and so on and so forth. When the torture report came out, it became clear that he really oversold his role in standing up to the Bush administration. You know, the thing is, he's self-righteous. He believes he's this great crusader who is always in the right. And that's what motivates him. That's what motivated him last July to go after Hillary Clinton. That's what motivated him in October. I'm not excusing it. I'm saying, understand what motivates this man. And I think that's what motivated him over the weekend. He wanted it to be very clear that the FBI was on the up and up. But again, even asking for that public denial of a FISA warrant is unprecedented. And, you know, he just wants everyone to love him and his agency. And at some point, the FBI is supposed to be about, it's not because it leaks like a sieve, but the FBI is supposed to be about quietly conducting professional investigations that only tell you the outcome if somebody is indicted. Because Jim Comey is trying so hard to make everyone love his agency, it's violating all these rules about silently and professionally investigating people.
Just remarkable. And then, you know, one thing happening after another, first the Sessions recusal, then the Trump accusations, then now the version 2.0 of the Muslim ban. This is also interesting. So, of course, Trump's initial executive order banning people from seven majority Muslim nations was struck down a variety of times. It ended up at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And essentially, it was found to be unconstitutional, which surprised nobody. Now he has a new version out that leaves, as far as we can tell, Iraq off the list, also backs off from permanently banning Syrian refugees. As far as you can tell, aside from that, does it keep the rest of the original executive order intact?
I think it also, if you already have a visa, then it doesn't retroactively take away your visa.
It sort of clarifies a position on visa holders, which the first executive order didn't clarify, leading to kind of this chaotic implementation.
Right. It fixes the things that were badly wrong in the first one that the Trump administration tried to fix by having White House counsel Don McGahn write basically a memo, which you can't do for an executive order to fix the problem. So, but it's interesting because in the interim period, two Department of Homeland Security intelligence reports have been leaked. The first of them showing that there was no tie between citizenship and who became a terrorist, and the second one showing that, in fact, people who are from other countries that engage in terrorism become, and I hate this term, become radicalized in the United States. And it's sort of funny because the Trump administration has offered two examples for why they need this ban. One is the Bowling Green case, where two Iraqis, of course, Iraq is not banned anymore, but two Iraqis came to the U.S. and were convicted of material support, but never attacked in the United States. The other even more interesting one is a Somali kid who came as a refugee and was troubled as a teenager. His father went to the FBI and said to the FBI, I think my kid is getting radicalized. And rather than intervening, the FBI basically kept throwing informants at this kid until he turned 18. They got him to press a button, and that amounted to, I mean, it's one of the classic stings that the FBI does to set up these young Muslim men as being engaged in an attack. And, you know, maybe the problem is we shouldn't have FBI doing this over and over again, rather than we shouldn't have Somali refugees come into the country. But again, Trump's rationalization doesn't make any sense. So
What you were describing sounds dangerously close to entrapment. A lot of people have argued that. So why is Iraq off the list? I mean, if Trump is worried about, say, ISIS operatives entering the country, the original name ISIS stands for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Iraq was one of the countries, by the way, that responded very angrily at the original ban, saying that they would reciprocate and ban the U.S. citizens from Iraq. But it's interesting, you know, why take Iraq off the list? Why not, you know, some other countries? As far as you can tell, what's the logic behind taking Iraq off the list, admitting that there was no logic for any of those seven countries to begin with?
I think because they are the ones who can retaliate in meaningful form. I mean, we already have troubled immigration relationships with Iran, Sudan. You know, there aren't functional governments in most of the other states. There is in Syria, but we don't care. We send our troops in there regardless. And so Iraq was the one place where it is important for us to not only have freedom of movement into Iraq, you know, because if we're not there, then Iran's going to come in and help Iraq fight ISIS. And of course, the government wants to prevent that. The other thing is, of course, it's hard to say that this country that we've completely destabilized by invading, that all of these people who helped us along the way, all of these interpreters or people who have, you know, are in danger now because of past cooperation with the United States, the ban affects people from all countries in that situation, but particularly in Iraq. There were so many interpreters who weren't able to come to the United States and were in danger as a result of that it was exacerbating things.
And by the way, as we speak, a family from Afghanistan who did get special immigrant visas to come to the United States, and that kind of visa basically means that they helped the U.S. military, are being detained at Los Angeles International Airport. And that family includes an 8-month-old baby and two other young children under the age of 10. They have no idea why this government is blocking them from entering the country on a permit that this government issued them. There are so many issues to discuss, Marcy, that it's hard to sort of, remember them all, because one thing eclipses another. But just because, we shouldn't be lowering our standards for what's considered news. So I want to bring up another issue, which is much was made of Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server when she was Secretary of State. Now we find out that Mike Pence, as governor of Indiana, also used a private email server. He even joked about it at a recent event with the press, and he's now our vice president. This is just kind of falling through the cracks, isn't it?
Right. I mean, he says that he was in a different situation because Indiana law permits the use of private email, whereas the State Department was moving towards the prohibition on private email, though wasn't all the way there, although Hillary had disciplined one of her ambassadors in part for his use of private email. The other distinction that Pence makes is that he wasn't engaging in classified information, whereas Hillary was. Although my suspicion is that there was more sensitive information on Pence's than on Hillary's, given some of the topics that were discussed there, things like terrorism arrests and homeland security issues.
And he did it all using an AOL account.
Yeah, which did get hacked.
Yes.
And that's the thing, is we don't have evidence that Hillary's email got hacked. We do know that Pence's got hacked. So, I always say, and I've been saying this for years, because email problems go back to Poppy Bush when he lost a bunch of profs notes pertaining to the Iran-Contra investigation. Every single administration has had their email scandals. And rather than putting teeth to the Federal Records Act and making it easier to use government email, making it easier to distinguish between government and political email, which should properly be distinct, making it easier to archive the things that need to be archived. Until we fix that problem, every administration is going to have an email scandal, and and the Trump administration will have texting scandals. And we're not going to fix the underlying governance issue, which is that the reason we want to have access to these emails and texts is to understand what was done in government, to be able to track potentially potential wrongdoing, potentially illegal behavior. And we're not fixing the underlying issue. We're just, serially engaging in gotcha over email.
Right. And there was a photograph of Hillary Clinton that went viral over the weekend. She was found sitting on a plane reading a USA Today article with a headline about Pence's private email server. A very ironic photograph. Finally, do you feel that a lot of these scandals, these political scandals coming so thick and fast, particularly the ones that show infighting between Trump's own cabinet members and himself, are going to be the downfall of this administration? Because there are on so many levels, everything that this administration is doing is so wrong, and grassroots activists are mobilizing very heroically. But it's almost as though we could sit back and watch this whole house of cards crumble on its own. Or is that being too bold?
I don't even think activists should want that to happen. I mean, I think, Democrats in D.C. want Trump to be brought down by the Russia scandal because it's easy, they say. It's the easiest way to get him out of office the most quickly, which, of course, would leave us with Mike Pence, who in many ways is even more scary than Donald Trump. But you're right. Activists are heroically working against Trump's policies. They're having limited success, but they are having limited success. And what that's doing is reestablishing the kind of social network that we have lost in the United States in the last decades, really, but certainly in the last 15 years. And so that's how we will sustainably push back against Trump's policies. It won't be the Russian scandal. It won't be all the leaks. It'll be stuff on the ground that convinces voters across the country that these policies are a disaster and that they need to reverse them.
And among those people who are doing very hard work are lawyers. As you and I are speaking, the news just came out that the Afghan family that I mentioned will be released because of the work that immigration lawyers have done in appealing to a judge. And so certainly a lot of individual work happening on many levels. Marcy, I want to thank you for the work that you've done and for joining us today.
Thanks, Sonali.
My guest is Marcy Wheeler. She's an independent journalist specializing in civil liberties, privacy, and the war on terror. You can read her blog at mtwheel.net. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.